In a nutshell, people who are scared are more easily controlled. We can be manipulated by those who want power over us if we're worried and they have a supposed solution to our perceived problems. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone in the Libertarian Institute. Today we'll be discussing how not to suck at life, 89 tips for teens. I promise they're not just for teens. Mr. Boyack, thank you for joining me. Where is the best place to purchase this book?
We're sending everyone to Amazon. Love or hate them, Jeff Bezos is really good at moving a lot of products. So it's all on Amazon.
What is the mission of the Libertas Institute that you are the president of?
So a decade ago, I founded a nonprofit because I felt like there were so many groups that were niche single issue groups and that the government impacts us negatively in 8,000 different ways. And we're never going to have a collection of 8,000 organizations, each working on one of those niche issues to protect liberty. So Libertas Institute, Libertas being the Roman goddess of liberty, the Statue of Liberty. Her name is Libertas, or as many in America pronounce it, Libertas. But that is the Roman goddess of liberty. Founded a decade ago, trying to be a broad watchdog for freedom, originally starting in Utah, which is the state I now live in. I'm from the Republic of California. I fled long before it was popular to do so. But I live in Utah now. So we were a state-based think tank focusing on state and local laws here. And now we've expanded across the country, passing a number of first-in-the-nation reforms and really impacting things to protect people's rights.
There are a number of tips you have here for us. I want to give you an argument of someone who might disagree with one of your tips, and you give me your rebuttal to this type of thinking or this mindset. First, great. To be woke is to be able to detect racism and sexism in areas where the untrained person might not be able to and bring attention to past injustice. Avoiding racism and sexism is a good thing. Therefore, it is good to be woke.
Oh, counter argument. So, you know, what is right in a woke person's eyes is often, I would say, in the mind of the beholder. These perceived injustices are just that. It's like when people call something a microaggression. The fact that we live in a world in which people's personal opinions are the basis for which you can control other people's behavior and say, you have to adjust to and accommodate my sensibilities. And if you don't, then I'm going to attack you and cancel you and so forth, is a total inversion of the way a healthy and productive society should be. So woke people see themselves as evangelizing, tribalism in a way, to protect a narrow ideological range of views that they want to impose upon others by, attacking those who've, dare to disagree with them. So what you read is interesting because woke people see themselves as kind of crusaders on a mission, that there are impurities to be purged from the kind of intellectual zeitgeist. And especially where I wrote this for teens, but certainly, as you point out, for adults and just people in general who can benefit from a lot of this stuff, I think that leads to a lot of, what's the best word? I feel like that would, again, going back to this healthy and productive society, I feel like it's antithetical to that. And for that reason, we should be very wary of these crusaders and the mission that they're on.
To compete in the world today, you pretty much need to go to college.
So a couple of years ago, I put together a book called Skip College with about 8 or 9 other people, including John Taylor Gatto. So if any listeners out there do not know John Taylor Gatto, he was a pioneer in alternative education, wrote some amazing books. His chapter contribution for our book, Skip College, was the last thing he ever wrote before he died. So we had the very good fortune, he passed away a couple of years ago, good fortune of having that in the book. Look, college is a signal, a college degree rather is a signal. It is a signal to an employer about something. Historically, it was a signal of competence, of commitment, of hard work, because it set you apart from the unlearned masses perhaps that did not have one. Today, anyone can get a college degree. It's extremely easy. It's free in many places. It's heavily subsidized. In a world where everyone has a college degree, the signal has lost its power. But it is an expensive signal because it costs a ton of money and increasingly so, which is why we have the school debt bubble. And you're subjected to the woke crusaders on campuses that are no longer the bastions of free debate and open inquiry of a spectrum of ideas, but a narrowing of ideas, a propagandization of a certain set of ideas that are deemed, appropriate and allowable, as Tom Woods might say, the 3x5 card of allowable opinion. And so college signals today no longer signal as much as they once did, but they also come at a very heightened cost financially and ideologically. And so for that reason, in my view, unless it's absolutely necessary, if you're going to be a doctor or one of these professions where you just can't do it without it, you don't need and rather probably should not seek to obtain a college degree. And even if you choose to go to college, if you have to, or in the net balance of things, you decide that, for your own ambition and pursuit, it's necessary, at least go in with eyes wide open, which our Skip College book does. And this book only gives you a tiny little morsel of, because there are so many alternatives to consider and strategies to utilize that would allow anyone, even if they go to college, to counteract the financial and ideological problems that they will be bombarded with.
All labor is worth at least $15 an hour. You should stay far away from exploitative apprenticeships and internships.
The counter to that would be many people who have had apprenticeships and internships that set them up for great success in life. I'll give you an example. When we have a great intern at our organization and we do pay a stipend and they're not making a ton of money, but they're not creating a lot of value. And so someone who wants $15 an hour has to create at least that much of economic value to justify their position. As we've seen, many restaurants will just automate things away because certain positions are not worth that much money, especially when you can invest in technology to do the job for cheaper. But when I have an intern who comes and works for me, even when they're just getting paid a little bit and they prove themselves that they can and do create value, I am going to find a way to hire that person and pay them as much money as they're creating value for, and increasingly so, because they've already got relationships with people in our organization. They already know what we do and what we stand for and how things work. I don't want to have to go find someone else and go through the interview process and take a gamble. I've had a great trial experience where this person has proved their worth, and it would be painful for me to lose them and to have to go through that process all over again. So for those who are actually productive, contributing members to our society and creating value for other people, apprenticeships and internships are fantastic opportunities to get your foot in the door, build those relationships, and demonstrate the value that you create. On the other hand, when you are a leech, when you are an unproductive member of society that feels entitled to certain things and you're not creating sufficient value to justify your compensation, then of course an apprenticeship or an internship might be seen as counterproductive to your aims, because you're not going to be paid very much, you're not going to be paid at all, and you're not having the right frame of mind to leverage that experience for your economic and professional success in the future. So it's really about mindset, and the problem is that those who advance that argument have a completely flawed mindset that cuts them off at the knees and leads them to continue to depend upon society and not be sufficiently contributing members thereof.
Stop questioning everything, much like those radical extremist conspiracy theorists do. No one is out to gaslight you. You're just being paranoid. Don't question everything, or don't question most things.
Adolf Hitler would love the person who advances an argument like this, as would every oppressor in world history. You know, the greatest intellectual thinkers and change agents obviously and always question things. I mean, the fact that today people say the science is settled is hilarious, because rewind at any point in world history and advance that same or utilize that same argument in defense of the status quo understanding of the time, and it would be laughable, right? The greatest discoveries have come from being skeptical and challenging the positions and statements of authority. It's no different in our day. It is intellectual hubris, I would argue, to say that anything is settled, right? Because it never is, never has been. At best, these are arguments to advance ideological agendas, and they're trying to weaponize a position against those who can be made to look like rubes and ignoramuses and anti-science and so forth. But nothing is settled. Everything should be questioned. And that is the mark, I think, of a healthy and productive society, always questioning itself, purging some of the, you know, traditions of our fathers that were incorrect, and identifying ways to improve. We are handcuffing ourselves if we don't ask questions.
Just as one would be wise to avoid consuming food with poison, one should steer clear of reading extremist ideas such as communism, fascism, imperialism. By giving them attention, you encourage bad behavior and waste your time.
So John Taylor Goddard, who I mentioned earlier, wrote a fantastic book called Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling, I think is what it was called. And the whole point of this is that there is an agenda behind those who created our modern Prussian-based industrialized conveyor belt government school system, and not just government, but increasingly a number of private schools, certainly the charter schools and otherwise, are modeled after this same type of approach. And the individuals behind our modern education system were Fabian socialists. They were atheists who wanted to advance a collectivist agenda in support of subordinating citizens to the collective. And by collective, I really mean those in power who wanted to control the masses. It was very much about homogenizing the public into a industrialized, controlled batch process of predictability, where, you know, we can conform society to the exact shape that we want, thereby maintaining and increasing our control over them and others as well. This was very much the ideological agenda of those who architected the public school system. So of course, it is in the best interest of a system to not teach anyone anything that is counter to that system. I mean, do we really think that the government school system is going to teach kids the perils of government, the dangers of what government has done? No, it extols its virtues, and look at these great presidents, and FDR saved us from the Depression and all these wonderful things, right? Look at the Federalist Papers and the Constitution, how glorious. Let's ignore the anti-federalists, everything they warned about that has come true today about having a centralized authority and a parchment barrier that will not do anything to protect our liberties against the centralized government. So of course, with communism and fascism and all the rest, like, those in power want us to ignore and avoid any messaging to the contrary of what they want us to know. And so, sure, it's one thing to say ignore communism and the extremities of totalitarian government. It's another thing to not explore what that means for us today, that even in a so-called republic, that there are many individuals who have utilized similar, like, I kid you not, Adolf Hitler's chief propagandist utilized a book, a strategic outline of how to propagandize the public that came from Edward Bernays, who was in President Woodrow Wilson's administration. He was the double nephew, both in marriage and himself, the double nephew of Sigmund Freud. And so Edward Bernays was the first individual to take Freud's kind of psychological studies and mix them with marketing and business to help individuals in the private sector learn how to influence people. He'd take those same learnings and then in Wilson's administration in World War I and all the rest, began to incorporate that when it came to government. He writes a book. He has this whole outline of how to control people using basically thought control and propaganda. Literally, it became the Nazis' handbook by which they were able to propagandize the masses. Bernays, for his part, when he learned that fact, he feigned horror and shock and, oh my gosh, you know, he has this quote where he's like, I couldn't have imagined that, you know, this horrific regime would use the things that I wrote about to do these things. And yet, to a different degree, I concede, but still a degree, he was used and his compatriots were utilizing the same approaches of propaganda to control the minds and therefore the actions of the many. So it is a dangerous person who does not want us to learn history, because those who don't learn from the past are doomed to repeat it. And the communists and the fascists and the socialists today want a populace that is ignorant of history so that we do not learn the mistakes of the past, so as to prevent them from recreating them in the present and the future.
Social proof matters. A lot of people are going to college, watching the news, etc., because these are the right things to do. The best thing to do is to follow the popular path.
I share in the book a fun story that I came across a few years ago, and not just a story, you can find this video on YouTube. There was a TV show in the 80s called Brain Games, and I think it was on like Nickelodeon or something, I don't remember, but National Geographic, that's what it was. And it was all about how the mind works and these kind of brain exercises and weird ways that the mind works. And so what was happening was there was this clinic that I believe it was an eye or an ear clinic. And this woman was walking by and saw an advertisement for a free screening. So she walks in, sits down, starts filling out the paperwork. A beep sounds from the overhead speakers. And the two people sitting next to her stand up and then sit down. She looks like, oh, that's kind of weird, you know, and keeps filling out her paperwork. The beep goes off again. These two individuals stand up, sit down. She's like, what's going on? Someone else comes in for a screening. They get their paperwork. They sit down near this woman. A minute or so later, the beep goes off again. The two original people next to her stand up, but so does this new person. They stand up and sit down. This goes on several times. Soon enough, the woman begins standing up and sitting down in unison when the beep goes off without having any clue about why she was doing it. And so it was very interesting to watch that. And the point that they were making is that we are controlled by our peers. Our mind looks for shortcuts. It's very difficult to expend the energy in our minds that burn the calories, literally, to have to think up unique thoughts and analysis. And so we look for shortcuts. This is why social proof exists. We look to our peers for cues about what we might do and how we might behave in a way that would spare us the mental energy burden and expense of having to figure it out on our own. So we are social creatures in that way. And so as we saw in this example with brain games, the exact same thing I argue and explain a little bit in the book applies to us as well. That if we rely on those shortcuts, we're going to be subjected to all kinds of bad examples. Like individuals can be smart, but groups are totally stupid. Like groups of people, when you get people in a group, they're stupid because they turn off their thinking and they just look to one another. And once someone stands up and gives an example or a few people are doing something, everyone else easily follows. World history is, of course, replete with examples like this, bearing out the truth that a silly thing like brain games and numerous studies have all demonstrated. So if we are individuals who care about our actions, our freedom, who want to be intentional about what we do and not just rubber stamp what other people are suggesting we do, we should be terrified by this natural response and find ways to guard against it, find ways to hedge against it so that we do not rely on social proof, because so often the public is wrong, right? It's 2 weeks to flatten the curve. Okay, let's all, you know, save grandma and help out. And then here we are with an oppressive government that is telling you can't sing in choir in church and, you know, you must get vaccinated and all the rest. So social proof is extremely dangerous. And anyone who has to be an individual, just a cog in a machine, needs to reject social proof and what others do as the basis for what they should decide to do on their own.
I'm trying to get into the mindset of the adults that I've seen fight over trivial nonsense at sporting events and concerts. So the argument might go something like this. When someone insults your ego in public, it's important to cause a scene by getting very angry to discourage that bad behavior in the future and to issue a punishment to that individual.
Oh boy. Yeah. I mean, I've been to some of those games and at no point do you draw the conclusion coming away from those experiences that that person was right. They responded the right way. I fail to remember a single instance in which that was my conclusion of coming away from that event. You know, like certainly any person who feels that their honor has been slighted, or that, you know, like they feel this like duty to like stand up or whatever. But obviously, like taking the higher road is always the best approach. And someone who wants to be an example, like we'll give you a silly example we can all relate to. I am often the target of criticisms and attacks on social media, and just by virtue of, you know, what I do and the organization I lead. And so when these attacks happen, I have a choice. Now, in the past, the previous Connor, I would argue the immature and inexperienced Connor, who at the time did not like being told that my behavior was immature or due to lack of experience. But looking back, a more mature and experienced Connor can concede that that was the case back then. Back then, I was living the meme that we've all seen of like the guy is at his computer and in the background of the cartoon, like the wife has opened the door and everything's dark, right? She's like, honey, come to bed. And the glow of the computer is illuminating his face. And do you remember what he says? He says, not now, honey, someone's wrong on the internet, right? And so like he's furiously engaging. And that was the old Connor. I was a keyboard warrior for truth. And I would go and I would vanquish every foe and I would point out how they're all wrong. And then it was very interesting. Then I started an organization, and even a few years in the organization, I found that I was actually allies with several of the people that I had previously been attacking on issue X or issue Y, but on issues A, B, and C, they were going to be some of my greatest allies. And I had to come up with a far more nuanced worldview that allowed me to see that I needed to figure out how to disagree with people on ideas, but not attack them individually or disagree with them overall as a person because of that issue, when they might be my greatest friend on another issue that we can unite together. And that became a very interesting thing for me to have to navigate and figure out. I need to learn how to handle disputes and disagreements and even outright attacks on my character or my position or idea in a far more effective way. And so now when I engage with these people who attack me, maybe sometimes with humor, which is always a great way to handle these situations, but even just respect and just calmly responding rather than getting all riled up. I can't tell you how many messages I've gotten over the years from people who observed that discussion on a Facebook group or wherever and say, I really like how you handled yourself. Like it caused me to reconsider my views. I've been thinking about it for the past few weeks and I think I'm actually libertarian, or, you know, I went and read this book. And like the fact that I handled myself a certain way allowed me to influence other people who I may have turned off if I had kind of engaged and stood up for myself or against, you know, that injustice. And so how we behave like very much influences others. And this is my critique of the Libertarian Party. Like when you have candidates up there stripping down of their underwear and having all kinds of like colored hair and crazy clothing and everything else, like I get it, right? Enjoy your freedom and you do you. But at the end of the day, our message is going to resonate with other people if it's packaged in a way that's appealing and endearing to them. And so we ourselves, if we want to persuade other people, if we want to be an influence on other people, we have to make sure that our behavior is such that we have an open door to express those ideas. If we're behaving in a way antagonistic or off-putting or alien to their whole worldview or how they, you know, see themselves, we're never going to be able to influence these people on the ideas. And so I'm someone who's always trying to package the ideas of freedom in a way that people not only will be able, like, open to it all, but attracted to. And I think we as a movement, so-called, have a lot of work to do in that regard.
On page 135, your chapter is titled, Be a Good Friend. What does it mean to be a good friend?
You know, this is interesting for me. I've done several interviews and a couple of them, they've asked me, do you have teenagers? And I say, no, my kids are 12 and 10. So I haven't yet had to go through that myself. But like, I've been a teenager and I was not the best teenager. So I didn't write these books based on my experience as a father dealing with raising teenagers. I wrote this for 16-year-old Connor because I know him well and he sucked at life. And so this is a manifesto of my own, you know, what I needed to fix when I was young for myself. And the one you point out, the reason I share that is the one you point out that comes to mind. I was very much a transactional individual, and relationships for me were kind of give and get. I think my personal nature is I don't have like a ton of close friends. Like I have a few very close friends, but I'm not someone who has like 200 friends and I don't need that personally. But like even with my friends, it was about me. I was very selfish in that approach. And so what I've learned through my career, my life, is that any relationship requires you to deposit far more than you withdraw. And so if you want to make an ask, if you want someone to do something for you, if you want people to serve you or help you or whatever, you need to show up for them first. You need to create value for them. You need to put deposits into that relationship and support them, go to their events, compliment them, create something for them, buy something for them, whatever it is. And so being a good friend, like how to not suck at life, and obviously the reverse, like how to do great in life, is to be a good friend. The more people you help, the more people you create value for and develop relationships with, you're going to have a bigger network. People are going to want to return the favor to you, that rule of reciprocity. They're going to speak highly of you, which is going to, you know, because I did a presentation for a youth group last night. And I said, your reputation is what people say about you when you're not in the room, right? It's easy, like, right, oh, yeah, so, you know, like when you're talking to someone or they can hear you, it's totally different. But when you leave the room or when people are in private conversation. What they say about you, that is your brand. And so if you want to have a good brand, good reputation, success in life, you should be there for other people, creating value, serving, helping other people, not with the expectation necessarily that you're going to be able to make an immediate withdrawal and have a transactional relationship, more just with this understanding that the more you do that, and kind of, I'm not like a new agey, you know, like whatever type of person, but like the more you kind of create value and throw that out there, like the rule of reciprocity is going to work. People are going to benefit you. You're just going to be the type of person who others want to help and create value for you because they, you know, feel indebted to you or they want to return the favor. And that's just the type of person that I know many of these people in my life who are far better at this than I am. By no means am I kind of on a pedestal here. I have a lot of room to improve, but I know a few people who I would say are like experts at being a good friend and creating value and being there for other people. And they're wildly successful, not because they are being friends in order to be successful. It becomes almost a byproduct of who they are. They attract support and investors and business partners and clients and all kinds of people to them, which leads them to be successful.
On page 157, you discuss the zero-sum mentality. What is the zero-sum mentality?
This is also called maybe the fixed pie mentality, where people assume that life is a fixed sum of resources or benefits. And if you succeed, that means that I won't succeed as much. The kind of entitled, unproductive dregs of society I spoke of earlier in our conversation, I think are particularly susceptible to this mentality because they don't see the world through an abundance mentality. They see it through a zero-sum game where if Jeff Bezos is making a lot of money, that means us workers are not, you know, earning very much. We have to take a bigger slice of the pie by forcing him to take a smaller success of the pie, rather than seeing, I love that Jeff Bezos is a billionaire because the more he succeeds, the more I'm going to benefit and there are going to be economic opportunities for me to do all kinds of amazing things. Thank you, because your rising tide has lifted my boat. Totally different mentality. And so obviously the successful people in life have an abundance mentality that are not jealous of other people's success. If anything, they're cheerleaders of other people's success. Whereas those who believe in a zero-sum game or a fixed pie type of mentality are very selfish, very entitled, very jealous of other people's success. And obviously, like, that is not, that is a good way to suck in life, I guess, is a good way to put it.
You recommend a number of books to read throughout the pages here. I want to quote from The Crowd, A Study of the Popular Mind. On page 30, Laban says, whatever be the ideas suggested to the crowds, they can only exercise influence on condition that they assume a very absolute, uncompromising, and simple shape. They present themselves in the guise of images and are only accessible to the masses under this form. What can libertarians learn from The Crowd, A Study of the Popular Mind?
Oh, man, a lot. It's a fantastic book. It's in my mind, it's up there with like The Art of War by Sun Tzu, which is often quoted as a strategic book for a lot of people. But this book is a particularly interesting one in two ways, offense and defense. It's helpful for libertarians to understand this book because we can defensively understand what others are doing with these approaches, these strategies to try and control us, to try and control others, to try and gain control of the system. So it's a helpful way to understand how the elite, so-called, try to exert control and have throughout time immemorial. There's a lot of principles and ideas in that book that apply. The second thing I would say is it would be helpful for libertarians to understand that book for offensive reasons and not to you know, pick up your enemy's weapon and then go use it against other people, but to use something in a productive way. We always say in defense of gun control, right, that it's just, a gun is just a tool and it can be used by someone to harm you, but it can also be used to like protect your life and, you know, beneficially. It's an inanimate object and it has whatever value or intent someone is using it for. And similarly, with some of these psychological strategies and some of these ways to order and influence society, you know, you can use it for ill, as many do, including Edward Bernays, who we mentioned earlier, and his Nazi buddies and all the rest. But you can also understand how to use these strategies to try and influence people in a beneficial way, because we as libertarians believe that our ideas and the philosophy and values that we hold are the most beneficial for society. If we want what's best for the world, for other people, it is our duty to leverage whatever marketing strategies, like psychological influences that we can to support our ideas and make it like again, this idea of making your packaging your message in an appealing way so other people will be attracted to it. In addition to that book, I'd say one is extremely important for us to all read. And it's a book called Influence by Robert Cialdini. And this is widely recommended as a business book and a marketing book as well. But this is their new edition that they just came out that's been expanded. Millions of these copies have been sold. This book, probably more than any book I've read, has enabled me to be effective at what I do in spreading the message of freedom, because he talks about the principles of persuasion. And if we understand how people are persuaded, not only can we understand how others are trying to negatively persuade us, again, in that defensive approach, but we can understand if we have our others' best interests in mind, if we want what's best for other people, it's almost like we have a moral imperative to figure out how to help those people work it out in their mind in a way where they come to understand and believe and then adopt these ideas. And it's those principles of persuasion that can help us kind of grease the wheels or get that message across, not to deceive people or mislead them or to manipulate them, certainly not at all. But these ideas and strategies are something that are basically how the brain works. And if we want to influence others' brains, we need to understand some of those mechanics. So these books that are widely utilized in other contexts, even like The Crowd, like you mentioned, I think libertarians would be wise to try and learn from these, some of the strategies that we can use to improve spreading the gospel of freedom.
On page 61 of Propaganda, Bernays says, "There are invisible rulers who control the destinies of millions. It is not generally realized to what extent the words and actions of our most influential public men are dictated by shrewd persons operating behind the scenes. Now, what is still more important, the extent to which our thoughts and habits are modified by authorities. What are the best ways to combat propaganda and make sure you're not a victim of it?"
So that book, I believe, was written about 110 years ago. And I know a few books that are more accurate and relevant about our society than that book. It's short. It's a terrifying read, but an essential, absolutely essential read. So for anyone listening who hasn't yet read it, do yourself the favor of reading that book. I would suggest that my answer to the previous question also applies here. By understanding these principles of persuasion and how we ourselves are propagandized, we can better be in a position of defending against propaganda and pointing it out to other people. It's the whole fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. If I don't learn, right, it's like the boy who cried wolf, right? The villagers, like, they don't learn, he keeps crying wolf. But then finally they learn. I would add a little exclamation point to this answer, and that is, with all this COVID crap happening, it bears out the tragic truth that I pinpointed in, not that it was novel by any means, but I wrote a book called Feardom, How Politicians and the Media Exploit Your Emotions. And I wrote this like 7 years ago or something. Tom Woods wrote the foreword at the time. It was very 9/11 heavy in terms of how fear-mongering was used to strip us of our rights, and certainly previous examples from the past as well. What we've seen is completely with COVID, how emotionally manipulated we are, that when we are scared, we collectively say to the government, save us, protect us. And the government says, okay, just give me your freedom. And we say, okay, here you go. And you know, then the government grows and we never get those freedoms back. And so if we want to not be propagandized, we have to recognize that this is emotional exploitation. As I talk about in that book, Feardom, our brain, again, I mean, so much of this is mind stuff. The brain is literally wired with two pathways for information input. And I'm not going to remember all the terminology. I wrote a book so that I don't have to memorize those things. One is like the amygdala, and the other is, I can't remember, but your prefrontal cortex. But the point is this. The pathway in your brain for the emotional delivery of information is a quicker pathway than the rational processing center of your brain. What that means is we're far more likely to be influenced and take action based on emotional factors than we are the slower moving, rational, logical side of our brain, the prefrontal cortex that requires us to kind of parse through things and think it out. We all understand this, right? Like a woman jumping up on her chair because of a spider, even though it's teeny tiny, and if she paused to think about it, she would understand it's not the biggest threat, but it's an emotional big reaction. And that's a silly example, but it highlights how we as individuals can be very emotionally manipulated. And people like Edward Bernays, being the double nephew of Sigmund Freud, and many others since, have clearly understood how the mind works in that regard and how our emotions can be exploited to scare us into submission and get us to beg for keeping us safe. And so I would add that as an exclamation point only to say that if we're worried about being propagandized, we have to recognize that so much of it is by bathing us in fear. And anytime news media or politicians or anyone else is highlighting scary stories and all these things, chances are they're trying to assert a narrative and advance an agenda that we have to be very, very skeptical about.
One of my favorite passages in Influence is his discussion on, I believe it's titled Commitment and Consistency. He says, "Psychologists have long recognized a desire in most people to be and look consistent within their words, beliefs, attitudes, and deeds. This tendency for consistency is fed from three resources. One, consistency is highly valued by society and it's beneficial to your daily life. Two, it's a valuable shortcut. And three, it allows you to recall the earlier decisions you've made and to respond consistently with them." What are some of the ways that libertarians can use consistency to promote the ideas of freedom?
The quick example that comes to mind is someone like Rand Paul, who has been right in every Fauci fight that he's had in Congress, and that wins credibility. Because when, like, Ron Paul, his father was the same way, right? Forewarning about all these things, taking an ideological stand, asserting a moral high ground, right? sometimes it takes a while for the public to catch up or to see that you were right. And yet when that happens, there are people out there who are going to pick up on that and who do and say, well, wait a minute, that's a trustworthy person. That's someone I should, you know, assign credibility to and follow and support. And so obviously the media is not interested in consistency at all. If anything, their business model is inconsistency and keeping people confused and never moving. So the media is not going to highlight those examples of consistency because it's a threat to what they do and what their practices are. So the downside here is that when we see those examples of consistency, they're not shouted from the rooftops. They're not widely publicized for everyone to see and for all of society to kind of have this moment of self-reflection and say, oh, we were all wrong. No, we as a people are led from one inconsistency to the next and ever changing and 15 days to flatten the curve. And now vaccines will be safe and effective. And now they're 90% and 85 and 80. And now we need booster shot. Like it's always just like Atlas Shrugged. Ayn Rand talks about this too. Just the never ending perpetuation of, you know, activity as a demonstration of like, you know, no, we're looking out for you and we're doing the right thing. Just follow us here and then here and then here and then here. Never pausing to say, well, wait a minute, maybe we're wrong, right? Like maybe we're not in like this fatal conceit that Hayek talks about. So what I would say to fellow libertarians is consistency is critical because it's how you build credibility and legitimacy. The problem with it that I perceive is that it's a long-term game. And there are only going to be a minority of people who spot that that consistency and do something about it. I think social media helps, as it has, for example, with Rand Paul and Fauci, and you have Fee and Jack Hunter and all these others who are always kind of pointing out every time Rand Paul is right against Fauci. And so we can kind of amplify those examples, recognizing, though, that we're also being bombarded with all kinds of other stuff. And so it's very difficult to penetrate that and get people to observe the consistency and thereby believe and act differently as a result of it. So I don't know how to make it a more immediate return on investment. It feels like it's a long-term game, but it's one worth fighting because I think it's the only way that we can demonstrate that we're right is by continuing to advance our truthful and moral agenda and wait as people stumble through all their ignorance and idiocy until they like repent of their ways and come join us on our side of things.
You also recommend the law in this. My favorite quote from the law is, if the natural tendencies of mankind are so bad that it is not safe to permit people to be free, how is it that the tendencies of these organizers are always good? Do not the legislators and their appointed agents also belong to the human race? What are the main takeaways from Frederick Bastiat's The Law?
Oh, my heavens. Too many to count. Such an amazing book. You may know, and I'm certain many of your listeners know, when Elijah and I start working on our Tuttle Twins books, we said, what's the first book we should, you know, do a book about? And for both of us, it was The Law. It was the most influential book for our own kind of red pill moment. Bastiat is good because he was funny, right? Like humor is such an effective way at like endearing other people to us and advancing our agenda. And so what I love about Bastiat the most, he has so many quotes. That one's one of my favorite. Like they're not made from a different clay than us. Like they're also humans, right? Like, and so silly little examples like that where people can't help but concede that, yeah, he's got a point, right? Even if they totally disagree with him ideologically. And so his examples, his satire was so effective. I think those are useful tools that we can learn from. You know, I think of, for example, if you're a member of the Libertarian Party with the whole Gary Johnson stuff, the most viewed political ad of that whole election, the Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump election, was created by some friends of mine, the Harmon brothers. And it was a dead Abraham Lincoln. They launched this campaign called the Balanced Rebellion. They filmed it in a weekend, and it was a resurrected Abraham Lincoln coming back to life saying, America, what the hell have you gotten yourselves into? Like, these are the two, you know, and I'm not a Lincoln fan per se, but the point is that this whole video was hilarious. Like, it was funny. He was like roasting Clinton and Trump. And the whole idea was like, hey, vote for Gary Johnson and we'll get one Trump supporter and one Hillary Clinton supporter. And so you'll cancel out one another's votes because everyone's always worried about voting for third party. And, oh, that means the other, you know, party's going to win. So let's pair up two opposite party votes so they cancel each other out. And then you both vote for Gary Johnson. So obviously the campaign wasn't ultimately successful, but it was a very effective way at delivering a message. It was the most viewed video of the entire election. And it was effective because it was funny and people remember it to this day. And it's just a good way that I think we can learn from to advance our narrative as well.
The book is How Not to Suck at Life, 89 Tips for Teens. Mr. Boyack, thank you so much for your time, sir.
Thanks, Keith. This was great. Appreciate it.